Thursday, a cool, showery day, and it could be cold enough with some snow up over the high ground for a time on Thursday, particularly in the north. And we keep that chilly, showery theme going to end the week as well. Quite a brisk easterly wind on Friday, and that does mean eastern facing areas will be coldest of all, around 7 or 8 degrees along the North Sea coast, for example. The best of the brightness again further west. Just the hint as we go through the weekend that the wind starting to come in from the south or the southeast, it will turn a little bit warmer, a return turn of spring perhaps by then, but that's some way off. A chilly prospect for the next couple of days. Mairead.
Thanks, John. John Hammond there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now, Simon Russell Beale reads the second episode of A Spy Among Friends, Ben McIntyre's new analysis of the damage wreaked by the spy Kim Philby. We begin with an interview between a senior MI6 officer and Nicholas Elliott, Philby's colleague, friend and contemporary.
Sit down, Elliot. I'd like to have a frank talk with you.
As you wish, Colonel.
Does your wife know what you do?
Yes.
How did that come about?
She was my secretary for 2 years, and I think the penny must have dropped.
Quite so. What about your mother?
She thinks I'm in something called SIS, which she believes stands for the Secret Intelligence Service.
Good God, how did she come to know that?
A member of the War Cabinet told her at a cocktail party.
And that was that. Nicholas Elliott and Kim Philby existed within the inner circle of Britain's ruling class, where mutual trust was so absolute and unquestioned that there was no need for elaborate security precautions. Elliott trusted his friend Philby to keep his secrets and never suspected that those secrets were now being put to murderous use. After leaving Westminster School, Philby had arrived at Cambridge on a history scholarship. In the 1930s, fascism was on the march in Europe, and only communism, it seemed to many, could oppose it. Late at night, over copious drinks, students argued and debated. The most colourful of Philby's radical new friends was Guy Burgess, amoral, witty, and loud in his advocacy of Marxism. Another was Donald Maclean, a clever young linguist destined for the Foreign Office. Unlike many of his friends, Philby never joined the Communist Party. His beliefs were radical but simple. The rich had exploited the poor for too long. The only answer was Soviet socialism. Before leaving Cambridge, Philby sought out his supervisor, the Marxist economist Maurice Dobb, who furnished him with an introduction into the Austrian Communist underground. It was that easy. The radical left had its own old boy network. In the autumn of 1933, Philby travelled to Vienna and introduced himself to a couple named Coleman and their daughter Litzy, with whom he promptly fell in love. Litzy was active in the Viennese communist underground and in contact with Soviet intelligence. Within 6 months, they had married and settled in London. In June 1934, Kim Philby sat on a bench in Regent's Park, waiting to meet a man of decisive importance who, his wife had promised, would change his life. He spoke English with a strong East European accent and introduced himself as Otto. His real name was Arnold Deutsch. He was the chief recruiter for Soviet intelligence in Britain, the principal architect of what would later become known as the Cambridge spy ring. At their second meeting, Deutsch asked Philby if he was willing to act as an undercover agent for the communist cause. Philby did not hesitate. Deutsch urged Philby to establish a new political image as a right-winger. He must become, to all outward appearances, a conventional member of the very class he was committed to opposing. Deutsch gave him the affectionate codename, Sonny. He began to instruct Philby on the rudiments of tradecraft, how to arrange a meeting, where to leave messages, how to detect if his telephone was bugged, how to spot a tail, and how to lose one. He presented Philby with a new Minox sub-miniature camera and taught him how to copy documents. Philby's double life had begun. He dutifully handed over to Deutsch a list of potential recruits among his left-wing Cambridge friends, including Donald Maclean, who was by now in the Foreign Office. Otto duly signed him up. Typically, Guy Burgess sensed he was being denied admission to a most enjoyable and risky party, and he confronted Maclean. A little reluctantly, Deutsch added him to his roster. But it was Burgess who introduced Deutsch to yet another recruit, Anthony Blunt, already an art historian of note. Slowly, discreetly, Deutsch was adding one link after another to the Cambridge spy chain. With his mixture of charm and competence, Philby's stature within MI6 grew swiftly, along with his responsibilities. By 1944, he was appointed head of a new section. Kim Philby, the veteran Soviet spy, was now in charge of Britain's anti-Soviet intelligence operations, in a position to inform Moscow not only of what Britain was doing to counter Soviet espionage, but of Britain's own espionage efforts against Moscow. As his contemporary Peter Wright later observed,
"At one stroke, he ensured that the whole post-war effort to counter communist espionage would become known in the Kremlin. The history of espionage offers few, if any, comparable masterstrokes."
In Moscow, Philby's new job in MI6 was also reflected in a change of spy name. Agent Sonny was now Agent Stanley. Over the coming years, James Angleton at the CIA and Nicholas Elliott worked ever more closely with Philby, the coordinator of Britain's anti-Soviet operations. Philby's position created a peculiar paradox. If all his anti-Soviet operations failed, he would soon be out of a job at MI6. But if they succeeded too well, he risked inflicting real damage on his adopted cause, Mother Russia. As the war ended, a handful of Soviet officials with access to secret information began to contemplate defection, tempted by the attractions of life in the West. In August 1944, the British Vice Consul in Istanbul received a surprise visit from Konstantin Volkov, a Soviet consular official. He and his wife now wished to defect to the West. The information he offered was priceless. A complete list of Soviet agent networks in Britain and Turkey. Among the Soviet spies in Britain, he revealed, were 7 in the British Intelligence Services or the Foreign Office. The head of MI6 immediately summoned his head of Soviet counter-espionage, Kim Philby. Philby read the memo with mounting horror. Volkov's allusion to the Soviet spy running a counterintelligence section in London could only refer to himself. The spies in the Foreign Office must be Guy Burgess, now working in the News Department, and Donald Maclean, First Secretary at the British Embassy in Washington. Philby arranged a hasty meeting with his KGB case officer and told him what had happened. The next morning, Philby suggested that MI6 send him to Turkey to extract Volkov in person. It was agreed, and Philby now gave the impression of busily making preparations while dragging his feet as slowly as possible. Philby finally arrived in Turkey 22 days after Volkov's initial contact. The following day, with Philby standing over him, the British Vice Consul dialed the number of the Soviet consulate and asked the operator for Konstantin Volkov. The telephone was answered by someone who claimed to be Volkov, but who spoke good English, which Volkov did not. The next call got no further than the telephone operator. She told him Volkov was in Moscow. Philby was privately triumphant. The case was dead. And so, by this point, was Volkov. A few hours earlier, 2 figures, bandaged from head to foot and heavily sedated, were seen being loaded onto a Soviet transport aircraft on stretchers. In Moscow, Volkov was taken to the torture cells of the Lubyanka, where, under brutal interrogation, he confessed. Volkov and his wife were then executed. Philby later reflected that the episode had been a very narrow squeak, the closest he had yet come to disaster. Thanks to Philby, the Russians were not one step ahead, but 2. Having divorced and remarried, Philby told his second wife, Aileen, nothing about his MI6 work, let alone his activities on behalf of Soviet intelligence. She knew only that he worked for the Foreign Office. But Aileen, too, was concealing something. Her mental health was deteriorating, and she would feign disease and illness to draw attention to herself. Secretly, she injected herself with urine, causing her body to erupt with boils. While in a clinic, she was badly burned after a fire mysteriously started in her bedroom. Philby turned to his old friend, Nicholas Elliott, who found the distinguished Swiss medical professor. He swiftly established that Aileen had suffered for years from Munchausen's syndrome. Philby was livid. He complained bitterly that Aileen had hoodwinked him and vowed he would never forgive her. As Elliot recalled,
"It was an intense affront to Philby's pride that he, an intelligence professional schooled in deception, had been tricked for so many years by his own wife."
In 1948, Philby accepted one of the most important jobs in British intelligence as the MI6 chief in Washington, D.C. Philby would be responsible for maintaining the Anglo-American intelligence relationship, liaising with the CIA and the FBI, and even handling secret communications between the British Prime Minister and the President. Philby was let into perhaps the most closely guarded secret of the Cold War. American cryptanalysts had intercepted some 3,000 Soviet intelligence telegrams and had uncovered evidence of a Soviet agent codenamed Homer, who was leaking secrets from within the British Embassy in Washington in 1945. The identity of this mole was still a mystery, but Philby knew better. Donald MacLean was Homer. Albania was poised to become a key Cold War battlefield. Many exiled Albanian royalists and nationalists were itching to return to their homeland and do battle with the communists. Britain would be training the Albanian rebels with the US as an enthusiastic partner. The mission was codenamed Operation Valuable. In October 1948, the first 9 Albanian recruits, disguised as local fishermen, were loaded onto a fishing vessel on the Italian coast and dropped off in a secluded cove in Albania. Colonel David Smiley, the British officer in control of Operation Valuable, waited with mounting unease for the Albanian guerrillas to make radio contact. Finally, a hasty message was picked up.
"Things have gone wrong. 4 men killed. Police know everything about us."
Of the 9 guerrillas who landed, 4 ended up dead, 1 was almost certainly captured, 1 had vanished, the others had barely escaped with their lives, and several Albanian civilians had also been arrested and killed, accused of aiding the guerrillas. The Albanian forces were primed and waiting, clearly aware of the incursion, if not of its precise timing and location. Colonel Smiley vowed to press ahead with fresh incursions and better trained guerrillas, and Philby was appointed as joint commander of Operation Valuable. His friend James Angleton was now in charge of foreign intelligence operations at the CIA. Angleton was rare and remarkable, a poet, alluring to some but faintly sinister to others. They began to lunch regularly at Harvey's, the most exclusive restaurant in Washington. The 2 men could be seen talking, drinking, laughing, and enjoying their shared love of secrecy.
"Our close association was, I'm sure, inspired by genuine friendliness. But we both had ulterior motives. By cultivating me to the full, he could better keep me under wraps. But I had one big advantage. I knew what he was doing for CIA, and he knew what I was doing for SIS. But the real nature of my interest was something he did not know."
Philby was producing more valuable intelligence for Moscow than at any time in his life. The CIA were baffled. Every bid to undermine communism by secretly fomenting resistance within the USSR and among its satellites seemed to be going spectacularly wrong. With ruthless irony, Philby told MI6,
"I do not know what happened to the parties concerned, but I can make an informed guess."
In London and Washington, as the operations lurched from failure to calamity, morale slumped and suspicions rose. Over the course of 2 lunch-filled years, James Angleton gave Philby the precise coordinates for every drop zone of the CIA in Albania. At the heart of the tragedy lay a close friendship and a great betrayal. Lunch at Harvey's restaurant came with a hefty bill.
A Spy Among Friends was written by Ben McIntyre and read by Simon Russell Beale. It was abridged by Barry Johnston and was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast, after a taste of Sailing By. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 26th of March. There are warnings of gales in South Atsira, Forties, Fisher, German Bight, Biscay, Trafalgar and Fitzroy. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Southern Baltic Sea, 1001, expected Humber, 1014 by 1800 Wednesday. Low Western France, 1004, moving southeast and losing its identity. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Atsira, variable 4 becoming northeasterly 4 or 5, veering southeasterly 5 or 6 later, fair, good. South Atsira, northeasterly, veering easterly later, 5 or 6, increasing 7 to severe gale 9 in south,